Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org. The podcast you're about to hear was recorded in 2011.
Hello. Welcome. Thank you all for coming out tonight. My name is Misha Stone, and I work in the Reader Services Department, and I want to welcome you to the library and thank you for joining us this evening. Someone who walked in said, you know, this is why I love Seattle, and I agree. It's a pleasure to welcome Jeffrey Eugenides tonight to the Seattle Public Library. Reader Services librarians talk to readers every day who tell us how much they love his books. And we also have the pleasure of being able to introduce new readers to his books. And I'm so glad that there are now three. So I want to thank the University Bookstore and Farrar, Straus, and Giroux for inviting us to host this reading. I want to thank the Seattle Times for generous support and promotion of our library programs. And I also want to have a special thank you to the Seattle Library Foundation, whose support makes possible so many of our free library programs. This program is being recorded for podcast. You can subscribe to free podcasts on the library's website at spl.org. And now I'm going to turn it over to Elliot from the University Bookstore.
Hello, everybody. It's awesome to see so many people out here tonight. I am Elliot with the University Bookstore, and first and foremost, I would like to thank the Seattle Public Libraries for letting us use their beautiful and very large auditorium to seat all of you guys tonight. We are glad to have him in Seattle this evening. He is the Pulitzer Prize winning novelist of Middlesex, which sold more than 3 million copies. He is also the author of The Virgin Suicides, which, as you may know, was turned into a film by the director of Sofia Coppola, and he is also the editor of a collection of short stories titled My Mistress's Sparrow is Dead. All of those we have for sale over at the bookstore table over there. But his newest novel that he's here to discuss with us tonight is called The Marriage Plot. It takes place mostly at Brown University in the early 1980s, and there's a whole love triangle. I could go on and on about how much I loved this book. It will keep you up way later into the night than you ever thought possible, because you will not want to stop reading it. You've heard enough from me, so please join me in welcoming Jeffrey Eugenides.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Have you ever seen the album Sinatra at the Sands? He comes in at the beginning of the album and says, "How did all these people get in my house?" And that's a little bit how I feel at the moment. It's great to be here in Seattle, number one, and at the Seattle Public Library, number two. My publisher was very excited to send me here, and now I see why. I'm going to read about 20 minutes from my novel and then take some questions. And the part that I'm reading, I guess this book is, in a way, a romantic triangle, but these kind of terms get applied to your book after you've written it. And while you're writing it, you never think things like that. Like, I'll write about a triangle. You just think there's this one woman and her boyfriend and another guy that likes her. And then suddenly, I guess you have a triangle. But I never thought of it that way. So to the extent that you cannot think of that way, I'll be happy about that. There's not much setup that I need to tell you about, but the character here, Madeline, is graduating from college, and in senior year she takes a course in semiotics. And she has difficulty reading Derrida and Umberto Eco and many of the thinkers in the class, but she finally finds one she likes, the Roland Barthes, A Lover's Discourse. And there are a few quotes in this section from A Lover's Discourse, and they're italicized. And I haven't found a good way to italicize my speech. So hopefully you'll be able to tell what's Roland Barthes and what's me. And if you make a mistake, that's good for me, because that means I'll be Roland Barthes for at least a moment. And the first quote goes like this: "The necessity for this book is to be found in the following consideration, that the lover's discourse is today of an extreme solitude." That's at the beginning of a lover's discourse, that the lover's discourse is today of an extreme solitude. It was debatable whether or not Madeline had fallen in love with Leonard the first moment she'd seen him. She hadn't even known him then, and so what she'd felt was only sexual attraction, not love. Even after they'd gone out for coffee, she couldn't say that what she was feeling was anything more than infatuation. But ever since the night when they went back to Leonard's place after watching Amarcord and started fooling around, when Madeline found that instead of being turned off by physical stuff, the way she often was with boys, instead of putting up with that or trying to overlook it, she'd spent the entire night worrying that she was turning Leonard off, worrying that her body wasn't good enough or that her breath was bad from the Caesar salad she'd unwisely ordered at dinner. Worrying, too, about having suggested they order martinis because of the way Leonard had sarcastically said, "Sure, martinis. We can pretend we're Salinger characters." After having had, as a consequence of all this anxiety, pretty much no sexual pleasure, despite the perfectly respectable session they'd put together, and after Leonard, like every guy, had immediately fallen asleep, leaving her to lie awake, stroking his head and vaguely hoping she didn't get a urinary tract infection, Madeline asked herself if the fact she'd just spent the whole night worrying wasn't, in fact, a surefire sign that she was falling in love. And certainly after they'd spent the next 3 days at Leonard's place having sex and eating pizza, after she'd relaxed enough to be able to come at least once in a while and finally to stop worrying so much about having an orgasm because her hunger for Leonard was in some way satisfied by his satisfaction, after she'd allowed herself to sit naked on his gross couch and to walk to the bathroom knowing he was staring at her imperfect ass, to root for food in his disgusting refrigerator, to read the brilliant half page of philosophy paper sticking up out of his typewriter, and to hear him pee with taurine force into the toilet bowl. Certainly, by the end of those 3 days, Madeline knew she was in love. But that didn't mean she had to tell anyone, especially Leonard. Leonard Bankhead had a studio apartment on the third floor of a low-rent student building. The halls were full of bikes and junk mail. Stickers decorated the other tenants' doors, a fluorescent marijuana leaf, a silkscreen blondie. Leonard's door, however, was as blank as the apartment inside. In the middle of the room, a twin mattress lay beside a plastic milk crate supporting a reading lamp. There was no desk, no bookcase, not even a table, only the nasty couch with a typewriter on another milk crate in front of it. There was nothing on the walls but bits of masking tape, and in one corner, a small portrait of Leonard done in pencil. The drawing showed Leonard as George Washington wearing a tricorn hat and sheltering under a blanket at Valley Forge. The caption read, "You go. I like it here." Madeline thought the handwriting looked feminine. A ficus tree endured in the corner. Leonard moved it into the sun whenever he remembered to. Madeline, taking pity on the tree, began to water it until she caught Leonard looking at her one day, his eyes narrowed with suspicion. "What?" she said. "Nothing." "Come on, what?" "You're watering my tree." "The soil's dry." "You're taking care of my tree." She stopped doing it after that. There was a tiny kitchen where Leonard brewed and reheated the gallon of coffee he drank every day. A big greasy wok sat on the stove. The most Leonard did in the way of preparing a meal, however, was to pour grape nuts into the wok with raisins. Raisins satisfied his fruit requirement. The apartment had a message. The message said, "I'm an orphan." Madeline's roommates, Abby and Olivia, asked her what she and Leonard did together, and she never had an answer. They didn't do anything. She came to his apartment, and they lay down on the mattress, and Leonard asked her how she was doing, really wanting to know. What did they do? She talked, he listened, and he talked, and she listened. She'd never met anyone, and certainly not a guy, who was so receptive, who took everything in. She guessed that Leonard's shrink-like manner came from years of seeing shrinks himself. And although another of her rules was to never date guys who went to shrinks, Madeline began to reconsider this prohibition. Back home, she and her sister had a phrase for serious emotional talks. They called it having a heavy. If a boy approached during one, the girls would look up and give warning. We're having a heavy. And the boy would retreat until it was over, until the heavy had passed. Going out with Leonard was like having a heavy all the time. Whenever she was with him, Leonard gave her his full attention. He didn't stare into her eyes or smother her the way Billy had, but he made it clear he was available. He offered little advice, only listened and murmured reassuringly. People often fell in love with their shrinks, didn't they? That was called transference and was to be avoided. But what if you were already sleeping with your shrink? What if your shrink's couch was already a bed? And plus, it wasn't all heavy, the heavies. Leonard was funny. He told hilarious stories in a deadpan voice. His head sank into his shoulders, his eyes filled with rue as his sentences drawled on. Did I ever tell you I play an instrument? Yeah, the summer my parents got divorced, they sent me to live with my grandparents in Buffalo. The people next door were Latvian, the Breverises, and they both played the kokel. Do you know what a kokel is? It's sort of like a zither, but Latvian. Anyway, I used to hear Mr. and Mrs. Breveris playing their kokels over in the next yard. It was amazing sound, sort of wild and overstimulated on one hand, but melancholy on the other. The kokel is the manic depressive of the string family. I was bored to death that summer. I was 16, 6'1", 138 pounds, a major reefer smoker. I used to get high in my bedroom and blow the smoke out the window, and then I'd go out to the porch and listen to the Breverises playing next door. Sometimes other people came over, other kokel players. They set up lawn chairs in the backyard, and they'd all sit there playing together. It was an orchestra, a kokel orchestra. Then one day they saw me watching and invited me over. And I asked Mr. Breveris how you played a kokel, and he started giving me lessons. I used to go over there every day. They had an old kokel they let me borrow. I used to practice 5-6 hours a day. I was into it. At the end of that summer, when I had to leave, the Breverises gave me the kokel to keep. I took it on the plane with me. I got a separate seat for it, like I was Rostropovich. And when I got home, I kept on practicing. I got good enough that I joined a band. We used to play at ethnic festivals and Orthodox weddings, me and all the adults. Most of them were Latvian, some Russians too. Our big number was Ochi Chornya. Yeah, that's the only thing that saved me in high school, the kokel. Do you still play? Hell no, are you kidding? The kokel? Listening to Leonard, Madeline felt impoverished by her happy childhood. She never wondered why she acted the way she did or what effect her parents had had on her personality. Being fortunate had dulled her powers of observation. Whereas Leonard noticed every little thing. For instance, they spent a weekend on Cape Cod. And as they were driving back, Leonard said, "What do? Just hold it?" "What?" "You just hold it for 2 days until you get back home." As his meaning seeped in, she said, "I can't believe you. You have never, ever taken a dump in my presence, Madeline." in your presence, when I am present, or nearby. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with it? Nothing. If you're talking about I sleep over and go off to class the next morning, then you go and take a dump, that's understandable. But when we spend two, almost 3 days together, eating surf and turf, and you do not take a dump the entire time, I can only conclude that you are more than a little anal. So what? It's embarrassing, Madeline said, okay? I find it embarrassing. Leonard stared at her without expression and said, do you mind when I take a dump? Do we have to talk about it? It's gross. I think we do need to talk about it. Because you're obviously not very relaxed around me, and I am, or thought I was, your boyfriend. And that means, or should mean, that I'm the person you're most relaxed around. Leonard equals maximum relaxation. Guys weren't supposed to be the talkers. Guys weren't supposed to get you to open up. But this guy was. This guy did. He'd said he was her boyfriend, too. He'd made it official. I'll try to be more relaxed, Madeline said, if it'll make you happy. But in terms of excretion, don't get your hopes up. This isn't for me, Leonard said. This is for Mr. Lower Intestine. This is for Mr. Duodenum. Even though this kind of amateur therapy didn't exactly work, after that last conversation, for instance, Madeline had more, not less, trouble going number two if Leonard was within a mile. It affected Madeline deeply. Leonard was examining her closely. She felt handled in the right way, like something precious or immensely fascinating. It made her happy to think about how much he thought about her. By the end of April, Madeline and Leonard had gotten into a routine of spending every night together. On weeknights after Madeline finished studying, she headed over to the biology lab, where she'd find Leonard staring at slides with two grad students. After she finally got Leonard to leave the lab, Madeline then had to cajole him into sleeping at her place. At first, Leonard had liked staying at the Narragansett. He liked the ornate moldings and the view from her bedroom. He charmed Olivia and Abby by making pancakes on Sunday mornings. But soon, Leonard began to complain that they always stayed at Madeline's place and that he never got to wake up in his own bed. Staying at Leonard's place, however, required Madeline to bring a fresh set of clothes each night, and since he didn't like her to leave clothes at his place, and, to be honest, she didn't like to either, because whatever she left picked up a fusty smell, Madeline had to carry her dirty clothes around the classes all day. She preferred sleeping at her own apartment, where she could use her own shampoo, conditioner, and loofah, and where it was clean sheet day every Wednesday. Leonard never changed his sheets. They were a disturbing gray color. Dust balls clung to the edges of the mattress. One morning, Madeline was horrified to see a calligraphic smear of blood that had leaked from her 3 weeks earlier, a stain she'd attacked with a kitchen sponge while Leonard was sleeping. You never wash your sheets, she complained. I wash them, Leonard said evenly. How often? When they get dirty. They're always dirty. Not everyone can drop off their laundry at the cleaners every week, Madeline. Not everybody grew up with clean sheet day. You don't have to drop them off, Madeline said, undeterred. You've got a washer in the basement. I use the washer, Leonard said, just not every Wednesday. I don't equate dirt with death and decay. Oh, and I do? I'm obsessed with death because I wash my sheets. People's attitudes to cleanliness have a lot to do with their fear of death. This isn't about death, Leonard. This is about crumbs in the bed. This is about the fact that your pillow smells like a liverwurst sandwich. Wrong. It does. Wrong. Smell it, Leonard. It's salami. I don't like liverwurst. To a certain extent, this kind of arguing was fun, but then came nights when Madeline forgot to pack a change of clothes, and Leonard accused her of doing this on purpose in order to force him to sleep at her place. Next, more worryingly, came nights when Leonard said he was going home to study and would see her tomorrow. He began pulling all-nighters. One of his philosophy professors offered Leonard the use of his cabin in the Berkshires. And for an entire rainy weekend, Lynn went there alone to write a paper on ficta, returning with a typescript 123 pages long and wearing a bright orange hunter's vest. The vest became his favorite item of clothing. He wore it all the time. He started finishing Madeline's sentences, as if her mind were too slow, as if he couldn't wait for her to gather her thoughts. He riffed on the things she said, going off on strange tangents, making puns. Whenever she told him he needed to get some sleep, he got angry and didn't call her for days. And it was during this period that Madeline fully understood how the lover's discourse was of an extreme solitude. The solitude was extreme because it wasn't physical. It was extreme because you felt it while in the company of the person you loved. It was extreme because it was in your head, that most solitary of places. The more Leonard pulled away, the more anxious Madeline became. The more desperate she became, the more Leonard pulled away. She told herself to act cool. She went to the library to work on her marriage plot thesis. But the sex fantasy atmosphere, the reading room eye contact, the beckoning stacks, made her desperate to see Leonard. And so, against her will, her feet began leading her back across the campus, through the darkness to the biology department. Up to the last moment, Madeline had the crazy hope that this expression of weakness might in fact be strength. It was a brilliant strategy because it lacked all strategy. It involved no games, only sincerity. Seeing such sincerity, how could Leonard fail to respond? She was almost happy as she came up behind the lab table and tapped Leonard on the shoulder, and her happiness lasted until he turned around with a look not of love, but annoyance. It didn't help that it was spring. Every day, people seemed more and more unclothed. The magnolia trees budding on the green looked positively inflamed. They sent out a perfume that drifted through the windows of Semiotics 211. The magnolia trees hadn't read Roland Barthes. They didn't think love was a mental state. The magnolias insisted it was natural, perennial. On a beautiful, warm May day, Madeline showered, shaved her legs with extra care, and put on her first spring dress, an apple-green baby doll dress with a bib collar and a high hem. Her bare legs, toned from a winter of squash playing, were pale but smooth. She kept her glasses on, left her hair loose, and walked over to Leonard's apartment on Planet Street. On the way, she stopped at a market to buy a hunk of cheese, some stoned wheat thins, and a bottle of Valpolicella. Coming down the hill from Benefit toward South Main, she felt the warm breeze between her thighs. The front door of Leonard's building was propped open with a brick, so she went up to his apartment and knocked. Leonard opened the door. He looked like he'd been napping. "Nice dress," he said. They never made it to the park. They picnicked on each other. As Leonard pulled her toward the mattress, Madeline dropped her packages, hoping the wine bottle didn't break. She slipped her dress over her head. Soon they were naked, raiding, it felt like, a huge basket of goodies. Madeline lay on her stomach, her side, her back, nibbling all the treats, the nice-smelling fruit candies, the meaty drumsticks, as well as more sophisticated offerings, the biscotti flavored with anise, the wrinkly truffles, the salty spoonfuls of olive tapenade. She'd never been so busy in her life. At the same time, she felt strangely displaced, not quite her usual tidy ego, but merged with Leonard into a great, big, protoplasmic, ecstatic thing. She thought she'd been in love before. She knew she'd had sex before. But all those torrid adolescent gropings, all those awkward backseat romps, the meaningful, performative summer nights with her high school boyfriend, Jim McManus, even the tender sessions with Billy, where he insisted they look into each other's eyes as they came, none of that prepared her for the wallop, the all-consuming pleasure of this. Leonard was kissing her. When she could bear no more, Madeline grabbed him savagely by his ears. She pulled Leonard's head away and held it still to show him the evidence of how she felt, She was crying now, in a hoarse voice edged with something else, a sense of peril. Madeline said, "I love you." Leonard stared back at her. His eyebrows twitched. Suddenly, he rolled sideways off the mattress. He stood up and walked, naked, across the room. Crouching, he reached into her bag and pulled out a lover's discourse from the pocket where she always kept it. He flipped the pages until he found the one he wanted. Then he returned to the bed and handed the book to her. "I love you. Je t'aime. I love you." As she read these words, Madeline was flooded with happiness. She glanced up at Leonard, smiling. With his finger, he motioned for her to keep going. The figure refers not to the declaration of love, to the avowal, but to the repeated utterance of the love cry. Suddenly, Madeline's happiness diminished, usurped by the feeling of peril. She wished she weren't naked. She narrowed her shoulders and covered herself with the bedsheet as she obediently read on. "Once the first avowal has been made, I love you has no meaning whatever." Leonard, squatting, had a smirk on his face. It was then that Madeline threw the book at his head. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And there's someone in the back is maybe raising a hand or scratching his head. Not sure. No? Anyone? Oh, you, sir. So the question is, how do I feel about film adaptations? What are my experiences with it, since two of my things have been adapted? The first thing you have to realize is that films and books are extremely different. And when a book is turned into a movie, it's going to be radically altered by the nature of being in the different medium. I saw Stephen Sondheim speak at Princeton 2 weeks ago, and he was talking about the experience of having Sweeney Todd made into a movie by Tim Burton. And there's one song in Sweeney Todd, the play, the musical, that is crucial on stage. All the characters are out in the town square, I think, and they all sing about their inner desires and sometimes sing about things that they all some miraculously understand together. And Tim Burton tried to use that. They shot the scene and they kept it in, but something wasn't working. So finally Tim Burton cut it out. And most people would be shocked by this because it is a crucial number in the play. Sondheim's reaction was that this was a good idea to do once he saw the film. Because if in the theater, when you come in, you have a certain suspension of disbelief about seeing choruses sing together on a single topic. That seems reasonable. You don't have a problem with it. But on film, if you keep showing different people's face doing the same thing, it looks very odd. And that's why the whole number wasn't working in the film. So they cut it out, and the film was all the better for that. And I would feel the same way if someone adapted one of my books. What I would want from them is to make, number one, a good film. I want it to be inspired by the book, and I want it to be faithful to the spirit of the book and the story that I've written, but they don't have to do it in the same way. An overzealous fidelity to the text could actually result in a very boring film. So I have two actual examples to measure this standard against. The first one is The Virgin Suicides, where I feel that Sofia Coppola did not try to violate my book in terms of what it was about, the atmosphere of the book, and the actual storyline. So that was a good experience. The Switch, which was the movie based on my story, Baster, already you can tell that perhaps they're starting to take some liberties by the fact that it's no longer called the same thing as the story, was a different instance because they changed it a lot. That movie the story is about an ugly man who is in love with a beautiful woman who wants to become pregnant. She wants to inseminate herself. And she asks all the best-looking and smartest guys she knows to contribute, or she's trying to decide whose semen she's going to use, and she doesn't ask him. And he feels awful about this, and the story is about the strategies he finally goes to try to change that fact. So it's about an ugly man using his wits to get his DNA into the next generation, basically. They wanted to have Paul Giamatti play the role of that guy, and he would have been really perfect for it. But then he couldn't do it, and they got Jennifer Aniston and Jason Bateman instead. And Jason Bateman isn't sufficiently unattractive for the role. So they decided to make him, instead of making him unattractive, they're just going to make him neurotic. And that is changing the actual story. So that's when I would be unhappy, because I don't understand why someone would adapt. I mean, I know why they did it for practical reasons, but if you are adapting a story and buying the rights to a story, it seems strange to actually write a different story. But they decided to make him neurotic, and the way they made him neurotic was that he wore sweater vests. when they called and they told me that that's what they were going to do, I was actually wearing a sweater vest. So that was a different thing. But that's a long way of saying that films don't kill off books. Books still have a life of their own. And a film is just something inspired by the book. It's not a copy at all. That was long-winded. I'm sorry. Yeah. Yeah. The question is my process, writing process day to day. I try to write every day. The most important thing you can do is to get a discipline of showing up at your desk, whether you feel like writing or not. If you stay in the room, something will get done sooner or later. So that's the first thing. At different times in my life, I've done different hours, but now that I have a daughter and a family life, I tend to write in the day from 10 in the morning to about dinner with lunch and, naps and things that happen to writers. So that's pretty much how it goes day to day. What else? The Germans have this term, Sitzfleisch. Do you know what that means? That means the Fleisch, the meat that you sit on, your backside. You have to gain Sitzfleisch so that you can sit in a chair to study a long time. They use it a lot for scholarship. So I think that's important in writing novels too. Because novel writing is, it's hard labor and it's long labor intensive. You can't just get inspired and dash it off. So, yes. Just the opening part. By the way, I see that your daughter is sitting on your lap, and I apologize for my reading. I didn't know. I would be off. I'd be really upset if I were you. And I'm upset at myself. I thought it was late enough at night. It was. I was writing another novel before that turned into this novel. I probably said that on the radio too. I'm sorry. It'll become clear. It's how much the schism in the English department at Brown when I was there influenced me, and did it become an allegory for this entire book? When I got to Brown, the English department was riven in these two factions. You had usually older professors who were new critical in their thinking, who had been teaching a certain way for about 20 or 30 years, and then you had another cohort who were semioticians, who were into the French theory that was just then becoming popular in America. And there was two very different ways of reading literature, and they battled, and finally the semioticians decamped and started the program in semiotic studies. So when I began writing this book, it started with the sentence, Madeleine's love troubles began at a time when the French theory she was reading deconstructed the very notion of love. And it was at that moment that I realized I could write about college, I could write about deconstruction, I could write about what it was like to be at a college at that time when these battles were going, and how it affected this character. Because she is traditional-minded in her literary taste. She likes the 19th century novel, Jane Austen, Henry James, and yet she realizes after a while that her classes and all her classmates are so uncool and so, you know, not with it, that she begins to envy or at least be curious about the cool kids who are reading semiotics down the hall. And she goes into that class and starts learning about semiotics and learns, first and foremost, that love is a construct, that we are, in a sense, taught to have romantic ideals by the novels that we've read and by the movies that we've seen. The epigraph for this book is from La Rochefoucauld, and it is, "No one would fall in love if they hadn't heard love talked about." So that's the idea. And so the predicament of Madeline is someone trying to emancipate herself from this way of thinking. At the same time, she's falling in love with someone. So her mind is telling her one thing, and her heart is telling her something else. And that appealed to me because I think it describes the position of the contemporary novelist, at least one of my age, who went through a class like this and learned a lot about semiotics and became skeptical of realism, skeptical of narrative, skeptical of the novel's capacity to transmit meaning. At the same time, that you want narrative and you want characters and you're still attached to some traditional, even old-fashioned things. I straddle that fence. And I straddle the fence in the same way that Madeline straddles it in her love life. Yes, in the back. So the question is, how did I go about writing the intersex narrator of Middlesex? And did I have qualms about appropriating other people's experiences? I guess to be a novelist, you can't have qualms about appropriating other people's experiences. Or you can only write autobiographical fiction in which you are the only person in every scene. Which actually is a pretty good description of the early fiction that I wrote in college. Tortured little stories about someone that never left the house. And I found that those were not very interesting to people after a while, so I started including other people and having other people say things. And little by little, I was appropriating like mad in every direction. But with Middlesex, obviously, it's a more delicate issue. But how I went about it and how I go about writing every kind of character is never to generalize. So when I began writing about this person who has 5 alpha reductase deficiency syndrome, I thought, I'm just writing about one intersex person. I'm not writing about all intersex people, and I'm not going to make statements or draw conclusions about them in the same way that if I wrote about Madeline, I would only be writing about a single woman and not all women. So that relieves a fair amount of anxiety on my part as I write it. There's a lot of technical difficulties of how to try to write something right from the point of view of an experience you haven't shared. So what I do, or at least what I did in Middlesex, was I gave Cal lots of my own biographical in details, born in the same year, born in the same city, grandparents, paternal grandparents from Asia Minor, things like that, so that he seemed more real. I had a place to stand, and from there I could invent this life that I haven't lived at all. In terms of appropriating too, that I had an interesting experience 2 days ago or 3 days ago in New York. Someone came through the signing line who whispered in my ear that he had 5 alpha reductase deficiency syndrome. And I've actually never met someone who actually has that condition. It's extremely rare. And he gave me a letter that he'd, you know, written and prepared for me. And I signed his book and he went off. And his letter said, it first began thanking me for the book and saying that it had saved his life in high school. And then at the end, it turned a little bit angry. He said, "You know, I love your book, but I hate it too because I feel that it is my book, and I wish I had been able to write it." So you can imagine how complex people's reactions can be when you write about subjects. I had there's a portrait of manic depression in this book, and I got an email from someone who said she was really ready to hate it because she has a similar condition, but she thought it was okay. So you just try it. I mean, you hope not to make people mad, but if you didn't, you would just never get outside of your own ego, and writing novels is all about forgetting your ego and going as far afield as you can. Yes. The question is, at what point do I crystallize how the novel's going to conclude? It differs with different books. With The Virgin Suicides, the first paragraph tells you exactly what's going to happen, and that was good for me as a first-time novelist because I knew what my job was. I had to have all these girls commit suicide in some way that would actually be surprising, even though I tell the reader what's going to happen. And with that book also, I wrote the last paragraph about a year before finishing the book, so I knew what the ending was, or at least the prose of the ending. With Middlesex, I didn't have a plan. I kept writing plans and revising them. And with The Marriage Plot, similarly, I kept changing the last third as I began to know more about the story and what had happened with the characters. And it was really quite late that I came up with the ending of The Marriage Plot. I find that it's better not to overplan your storylines and your plots, because if you're starting too early, the ideas you come up with for what the characters should do are always very simplistic, and the reader finds them simplistic as well. But if you experience the story as you're writing it, then you make more interesting, more unusual decisions about what happens to them, but you have to wait till you're in three quarters or further in. So I plan in order to think that I know what I'm doing so that I'm not too nervous, but I never stick to my plans. I always change the plans. Here's a hint. The question is, how would people in college, people the same age in my book, in a way respond to this book and the questions of love it brings up and the semiotics? Semiotics is still percolating along. I've talked to some recent graduates of Brown and other colleges, and they've read the same books. It's not at the fiery pitch it was at when I was in college, so they can take it in without it being a real decision about, you know, whether they're going to become a convert or not. That's number one. Number two is that I've read this book at colleges, and I've read the scene I read tonight at colleges, and it seems to ring true because boyfriends are still really troublesome even now. They haven't really changed that much. They say the same kinds of things. So I feel like it's a contemporary novel and that the emotional material is very much the same. The difference would be they would be communicating and texting and things like that would happen. But I don't think that actually alters the fundamentals of romance. Yes. That's a hard question. Something just seems like a compelling story to me, enough so that I decide that I'm going to write about it for a number of years. They've come in different ways. The first one came because I actually met a teenager who said she and all her sisters had tried to commit suicide. So I got that idea from an actual person, and I only met her once, and I was left with the mystery of that. Like, why would they do that? And Middlesex came from a number of ways from reading Ovid in high school and coming upon the figure of Tiresias. They have this argument in Ovid in the Metamorphoses where Zeus and Hera are arguing who has a better time in the sack, men or women. And Zeus says that women do and Hera says that men do, and they argue about it. But no one can decide, so they decide, let's ask Tiresias. He's been both male and female. He knows. So they bring Tiresias in, and he says, if the pleasures of love be as 10, then 3 times 3 belong to women, the rest belong to men. So sorry, guys. that's what he said. So I just, I remember seeing Tiresias in this poem and thinking, what an amazing character. He knows more than anybody else. They have to bring him in. And I wanted a narrator of such omniscience and such wisdom. It, you know, as a novelist, you're trying to know as much as you can about both sexes. So why shouldn't a narrator be hermaphroditic in his knowledge? And so that's why that one. And this one, this one came in for because of that sentence that I quoted, and also because I'd been thinking a lot about the marriage plot in the English novel, the traditional plot in a Jane Austen novel or a Henry James novel, where a woman is beset by a number of suitors, and the action of the novel involves her choice. Those are great, wonderful novels. Many of us love those novels, but you can't write them anymore because society has changed so much that the situation isn't the same. Anna Karenina could get an easy divorce now and be happy. She could move to Puget Sound and live out here. And Vronsky could become a personal trainer. And it would be, she would be fine. She would never kill herself. But I wanted to write a modern marriage plot. I wanted to write a book that is a marriage plot and isn't a marriage plot, and one that draws from tradition but at the same time isn't averse to modernity. So I did it, and what I came up with was this idea that the marriage plot no longer functions as a plot, but it functions in our head. We've internalized the marriage plot, and it still lives out in its literary and actually non-literary ways. No, you already went. Yes. I have another idea for a novel that I have to do some research on to see if I could possibly do it. When you finish one kind of novel, you tend to want to do something slightly different. This one, I'm not going to make such a divergence as my other novels, I don't think, in terms of the manner in which it's written, at least. One more. What? Way up there? Okay. Last one. Mm-hmm. Why did I choose to put religion in this novel? A couple of reasons. Certainly, this book has various traditional novelistic themes in it. And one of the ones that I liked so much in reading Tolstoy was the theme of religion or the search for truth, however you want to describe it. But Konstantin Levin in Anna Karenina is always losing his faith and trying to get it again. And at the end of the book, his daughter is born, and he's brought face to face with, you know, the power of creation, and it's a kind of a religious moment, and it's a wonderful moment, and it's the kind of moment you never encounter in contemporary fiction, or you rarely encounter it, because people have just forgotten about religion as an aspect of human life, and it seems to me that A, religion still plays a big part of life, even if you don't believe in anything, and the question of you know, why we are here and what we're doing here and how we should act is still something everybody thinks about. So why are so few novels dealing with that in a religious way? So that was the reason I put it in this book. And also it functioned in terms of Mitchell's character, because he turns part of his turn to religion is a wish to escape his body. And part of his wish to escape his body is because he can't get Madeline's. And there's a kind of anguish in him that makes him want to turn to mist and become mystical. So it worked for his character, and it worked as something that I wanted to try to restore to the novel. Okay, well, thank you so much for coming tonight.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation, and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.